terribly sorry about that.
We're 5 minutes in. I really apologize. Okay. All right, I'm going to start all over again. Okay. So the question of canonization is a little bit of a tricky one. It could have happened any time from the 2nd century BCE. That's the Hasmonean period. We're living under the Greeks. It could have happened as far into the rabbinic period as the 4th or 5th century CE. And we know this because the earliest rabbinic text, the list of biblical texts that we have that's the earliest, is in Bava Batra, right? That's the Babylonian Talmud edited in the 5th or 6th century CE. And the Mishnah, written in around 200 CE, is debating which book should be in or out, right? Which suggests that there's still a little bit of a lack of clarity. Of course we have the Torah by them. No question about that. We have the Nevi'im for sure. But writings, Ketuvim, not totally clear. Should we canonize Shir HaShirim? Seems very sexual, right? What about Kohelet? Seems very heretical and extremely Hellenized. Extremely. And so, what do we do with these texts, right? On the other hand, there are books that seem extremely pious that end up being excluded. Judith, very, very pietistic text. Ben Sira, cited by the rabbis as authoritative, doesn't make it into the canon list. So there's a fluidity of canon, I think, up until the early rabbinic period. This has to do with the fact that in the Second Temple period, we're getting to this, Archie. In the Second Temple period, and if you've heard me speak, you've heard me say this, I always mention this is a very, very important fact that I think people forget. What are Jews writing on in the Second Temple period? What are they writing on? What are they writing their scriptures on? Scrolls, right? Scrolls. Now, by the 2nd century CE, we're using the codex. We're using books. Okay, so if you are a Jew living the Second Temple period, would you be able to afford a very expensive, large, and unwieldy scroll? And that scroll would just be a Bereishit, right? You didn't have a scroll of the Torah like you have today. Every scroll has a separate book. Everything okay? So you would have a scroll of Bereishit, a scroll of Shemot. But a private citizen who's not very wealthy wouldn't have all 24 books of the Bible, right? Now, you might have a scroll of Shoftim because that's a very interesting book, but you might not have Yehoshua because, I mean, I don't want to say it, but Yehoshua is not like, you know, the most gripping necessarily of all the books. You might have Malachim, very, very exciting, but you also might have a scroll of Jubilees, a rewriting of the book of Genesis. Very popular. 15 scrolls of Jubilees were found in the Dead Sea Caves. Right? You might have the book of Judith because Judith was an incredibly popular heroine in the Second Temple period. Quoted all the time. You might not have Esther, right? Because what's the happy ending of the book of Esther? Intermarriage. Nobody likes to say it. But that's the happy ending of Esther. They walk off into the sunset married, right? The Midrash jumps on that, of course, but that's just the Midrash. So we have these scrolls, right? But then when we start to use the codex in the 2nd century CE, then we have to say, okay, what is in this book? What is out of the book? With the codex comes an urgency to canonize. We have to decide what is in and what is out. There's no more fluidity. Like I said, not being that heretical. Because, of course, by the end of the Second Temple period, we have the Torah, right? Nobody's saying, oh, look, at the 6th book of the Torah, right? We don't have evidence of that, right? And we have Nevi'im. But the later books, there is fluidity. Again, the rabbi cite Ben Sira as an authoritative text. There absolutely is fluidity. Before we get to this period of canonization in the rabbinic period, Jews are interpreting and interpreting their texts. And they're seeing challenges in the scriptures. And when they're writing interpretations of the text in a genre that the rabbis call rewritten Bible, a very problematic term, because they're not rewriting the Bible, but when they're rewriting, they're not trying to replace. They're paying homage. And that's very important. When we look at the text that we're going to look at today, we're going to see changes that are made to the scriptural story. And it's not because they're saying, oh, well, I'm going to replace the story, or I think that the story is not intelligent, or not well-crafted, or not divinely inspired, but it's an act of homage. And the story that we're going to look at today is Genesis 12, Bereishit Yobet. Now, this is a story that I want to look at because a lot of Second Temple interpreters do very interesting things with this story, because it's a very challenging one. This is the story of Avraham putting Sarai at risk. Well, he's Avram, right? Avram putting Sarai at risk. There's a famine in Canaan. They go down to the land of Israel right after God said Lech Lecha. I mean, this is 10 verses after Lech Lecha. They have to go to the land of Egypt because that's the only place that's self-irrigating where it's not affected by famine, right? And Avram has this grand idea. I'm going to by mistake say Abraham, but Avram has this grand idea. And what is the grand idea that he tells Sarai?
She
right. Great idea, right? Because if they think we're married, what will they do to me?
Kill.
Now, if they think that Sarai is Avram's single sister, what will they do to her?
Marry.
Someone said marry. It's more like rape. I mean, abduct, we might say. Force her into the harem. It's not marry. And it would be, quite a terrible thing to happen to Sarai, to be taken into the court of the Egyptian pharaoh without her consent. Okay, so the story, and we're not going to read this whole thing, but if you look at the underlined in verses 12 and 13, Avram says to Sarai, when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and then they'll kill me, right? Very explicit. We don't have to read into this. It's in the text. He tells her exactly why he is making this plan. But they will let you live, right? I mean, they'll abduct you, but they'll let you live. Say you are my sister so that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared on your account. Does this seem, I mean, when we think of Avram, right, we think of the considerate, the obedient, the silent. I mean, by the way, Avram is none of those things. He argues with God all the time, Genesis 19, with the story of Sodom. Right?
Doesn't this sound a lot like the Pelegish of Giva when you get shoved out the door?
Yeah. So that story is written with an eye towards this story, and even more with an eye towards the story of Sodom. But good insight. Okay, so what do you do with a text that is making the patriarchs look less than perfect? Especially when you're a Jew living in the Greek world, and the heroes of the day are perfect, infallible, embodying all the virtues, right? In the Greek world, right, what was a Homeric hero like? They didn't have any flaws. They were brave, they were smart, they were cunning, but they were empathetic, and they were pious, and they were religious, right? Second Temple interpreters also want their biblical heroes to be infallible. We see that in the rabbinic period, the rabbis are much more comfortable with imperfect biblical figures. So the rabbis are much more comfortable making Avram a three-dimensional, not totally perfect human being, right? A person. Whereas the Second Temple interpreters lift him up so that he's almost superhuman. They're working in this Hellenistic framework where if you are going to argue that your religious tradition has integrity, you have to compete with those Greek heroes. And you have to argue that your traditional heroes have integrity that correlates with those Homeric heroes. So, we're going to look at a text called Jubilees. This book is actually very anti-Hellenist, but ironically draws sometimes from Hellenist sources, maybe. It's written in Hebrew. Maybe Jubilees doesn't have Hellenist sources, but is aware of Hellenist ideas. Written in Hebrew, likely in the land of Israel, 2nd century BC. It's a big debate whether it's the beginning or the end of this. Do you want a whole shiur on that? Whether it's 175 or 125? No, okay. And what this book is, it's a rewriting of Genesis and the beginning of Sefer Shemot. Like I said, there are 15 copies of Jubilees found in the Dead Sea Caves, but it's probably not written by a member of the Dead Sea sect. It was probably brought there from the outside. Jubilees has a lot of very interesting ideas. On the one hand, Jubilees is almost rabbinic in the sense that the author insists that the rabbis kept all the mitzvot. Avraham kept the holidays, right? Even Pesach. I mean, we think of that as like being a Rashi that we learn as kids, right? But this is a pre-rabbinic, right, Second Temple source that argues the rabbis knew the mitzvot, they observed all the holidays, holidays that commemorate things that happen after the patriarchs live, right? So it's very interesting. On the other hand, Jubilees is in a class of his own in that he vociferously argues for a solar calendar. So what would that mean in the Second Temple period? If you use a solar calendar, you did not keep Yom Kippur on the same day as other Jews, right? So that means that he thought the vast majority of all other Jews were observing Judaism wrong, incorrectly. Maybe I'll take questions at the end because I want to get into the text. And so Jubilees is a fascinating source. Does he represent a large community of Jews who observe Judaism with the solar calendar? We don't know. We don't know the historical context or the community that this person lives in. But he thinks all Jews are basically doing it wrong. Very interesting. And so what does he say? One of the big agendas of this book is to present the patriarchs as perfect and infallible. And so when we look at this first paragraph in Jubilees, let's think about how the author is very carefully making small changes to present a different picture of Avram. So does somebody want to read, "And Avram went into Egypt"? Loudly for the recorder. Anybody?
Wow.
Okay, please.
"And Abraham went into Egypt in the third year of the week."
There are weeks, every week is 7 years in Jubilees. There's a whole calendrical system that he's working with. So just keep going.
"And he dwelt in Egypt 5 years before his wife was torn away from him."
Right, passive voice. Right? His wife was just torn. He doesn't know how it happened. He's like, "Woo, there she goes." Right? Woo. Right? And then look, "And it came to pass."
"And it came to pass when Pharaoh seized Sarai, the wife of Avram, that the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife."
Okay, now could it be that he just doesn't know the text? Unlikely, right? What is he skipping here? "It came to pass when Pharaoh seized Sarai, the wife of Avram, that the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues." We're totally missing
the sister part.
The plan, right? We're missing the fact that Avram initiates this entire thing from start to finish, right? Pharaoh takes Sarai. Avram has nothing to do with it. Everything's in passive voice. Pharaoh gets played. Then he gives back Sarai. Look at the underline. The wife of Avram. And he sends them both out with lots of loot, with lots of booty, and they move on with their lives, right? In the next paragraph of Jubilees, if you turn the page, you see the story of his conflict with Lot. And likewise, there's a little bit of a whitewashing with Avram's involvement in this conflict. And if you look at the very last line, we're told, "It grieved Avram in his heart that his brother's son had parted from him," right? We don't have any evidence of that in the Tanakh, that Avram is like, "No, I don't know what to do because we're family." And no. I mean, it's quite amicable that they part. So isn't it Avram's idea that they separate? I believe it is. So there's a very intentional effort here to make Avraham sort of separate from the conflict. Avraham has nothing to do with Sarai's abduction. It's a very traditionalist text. Now I want to contrast that with a fascinating scroll that was also found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we don't have any other copy of it. It was only found in the Dead Sea Caves. And so it was likely written by someone who lived among the Dead Sea community in the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea in the maybe 1st century BCE, 1st century CE, and this text is called the Genesis Apocryphon. Intriguing term. It's very incomplete what we have. Most of it is ripped off, lots of lacuna, lots of scratch out words. So when you see the ellipses, the dot, 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 that's not me skipping words. That's we don't know what those words are in between these phrases. Unless I put in brackets. Brackets, you'll see, those are from me. But if you see the dot, 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 that's just because we don't know what was written there. So we have a very incomplete version of Genesis Apocryphon. But we have this fascinating account of Genesis 12, where instead of skipping part of the story, the writer proactively inserts a lot of information, and it looks very midrashic. Is anybody familiar with the Genesis Apocryphon? Okay, so this is going to be fun. So basically what the author does is he inserts a divinely inspired dream into Avram's experience. And this dream hatches the plan for Avram. So everything Avram says to Sarai in the biblical text is true, but what we don't have in the scriptural text is the dream. And so Genesis Apocryphon fills that in for us. So I'm going to read this, if you don't mind. Unless somebody in the front... Yeah, let's have a volunteer. Someone close to the microphone. Okay, please. Thank you.
From the beginning?
Let's see. Why don't you start with... "And I, Abram, dreamt a dream." It's six lines down in the middle.
"I, Abram, dreamt a dream, and behold, I saw in my dream a cedar tree and a palm tree. Men came, and they sought to cut down the cedar and to pull up its roots, leaving the palm tree standing alone. But the palm tree cried out, saying, "Do not cut the cedar tree, for cursed be he who shall fell it."
Right, who shall cut it down.
Mm-hmm. And the cedar tree was spared because of the palm tree and was not felled.
And then this is the dream. And then he wakes up and he's like, "Oh my gosh, I dreamt a dream and I'm fearful because of this dream." What is this dream? So we don't actually get an explicit interpretation here. What?
Fiddler on the roof.
Oh, yes. If Saitama marries Laser. Right. So I have to think about that. I like that a lot. Okay. So we don't really have much help. We just know he's scared. He dreams this dream. And then they say, okay, we're going to make up, we're going to, you know, have this plan. So before we go on to the next paragraph, let's just think about this. A palm tree, a cedar tree. Who do these represent?
Cedar tree is
good.
And the palm is so right.
Good. Oh, that's great. Okay, you did that so quickly. Okay, so, but why? What's the difference between a cedar tree and a palm tree? Visualize them. What does a palm tree look like? Beautiful. Pretty.
Sweet.
Right, and
It has fruit.
Right. Oh, fertile. Ooh, that's great.
Big hair.
Big hair. Oh, yeah. Very attractive. Right, and now what's a cedar? What does a cedar look like?
Sturdy.
Sturdy. Much taller than a palm tree, right? And you can use the cedar tree, right? I mean, the cedar trees of Lebanon, right, were used to build Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash. Shlomo brought the cedar trees down from Lebanon, right? So they're valuable. They're strong, and they're kind of necessary to build up civilization.
They also preserve. If you keep clothes in a cedar closet, it keeps.
I never thought of that. That's fantastic. Yeah. That's great. That's great. And a palm tree might not have the most pragmatic benefits, right? You're not going to use palm tree wood to build a house. Okay, right, so pretty, right, so like it enhances your holiday, right? The fruit might smell beautiful, and it enhances, but it's not strong and sturdy and large, right? So we can see why the author very elegantly chooses to depict Sarai as a palm tree, right? She's vulnerable, she's a little more delicate, she's smaller, she's beautiful, and the cedar tree is Avram. So I think this is actually very, very elegant imagery. Okay, so now we know. Sarai is the palm tree. So now go back into these verses and let's see it again. Men came and they sought to cut down the cedar tree, right? So in this reading, whose life really is more central to the story?
Avram.
Right. Right. They might abduct Sarai, but they're really interested in abducting and felling Avram. Okay? And they want to pull up its roots. So what would that symbolize?
Destroy his family.
Destroy his values, destroy his family, everything that he stands for. The Abrahamic family needs to be eradicated. Whether Sarai is part of that or not really doesn't impact, right? Avram is at the center of that dynasty. Leaving the palm tree standing alone, right? Presumably, Sarai can go enter into someone else's dynasty, right? Joe Schmo's dynasty. So the palm tree, though, is the one who saves Avram. She, and this is the most important part of the dream, because Avram wakes up and says, "I was threatened, but you saved me." Right? The palm tree in the dream is the one who takes initiative. He doesn't say, the cedar doesn't say, "Oh no, don't cut me down." The palm tree intervenes and says, "Do not cut down the cedar tree." Right? She sacrifices herself in a way, right? She's not worried about herself. She says, "Do not cut down the cedar tree, for cursed be he who shall fell it." And the cedar tree was spared because of the palm tree. So this is not, you know, a feminist 21st century text over here. There's an unabashed emphasis on the well-being, on the preservation of the family of Avram, whether Sarai is part of that or not, is almost negligible. We don't have to pass judgment. That's just the reality of the text, right? Okay, and now he wakes from the dream. "During the night I woke from the dream, and I said to Sarai, my wife," and remember, this is a pious Jew. I think sometimes we make a big mistake with Second Temple texts. We say, well, you know, these aren't necessarily quoted by the rabbis, or they're not in the Tanakh. So they're marginal to our tradition, right? They're peripheral to whatever normative Judaism was in the Second Temple period. I think it's a huge mistake. And because we don't learn Second Temple texts as a formal curriculum, I think what often happens is that we go from the end of the Tanakh to the beginning of the Mishnah in our heads, right? And so we end the Tanakh with proto-rabbinic figures. We turn Ezra and Nehemiah into rabbis, right? And then we just go into, like, it was like this easy transition, like Ezra and Nehemiah, 539, oh, it's 70 CE, and now we're in the rabbinic period. Everything between those years reflects, I mean, of course there were assimilated Jews, but these texts are pious. They represent normative thought. For sure, you know, Jubilees has a solar calendar, so I don't know how normative that is. But Jubilees also preserves traditions about the patriarchs that make their way into Midrashic tradition. So there are no clear binaries of in, out. Again, there's fluidity here. And I think that these texts really represent what a lot of Jews were thinking and reading. Okay, so, you know, we shouldn't say, oh, I heard this interesting thing from Malka Simkovich, but, you know, those were like the crazies in the first century BC. And, you know, then the rabbis came along and righted all the, you know, made everything straight. Okay, so let's finish this text. And if you have questions, please remember them. And I'll try to make time of the, oh, no, do we only have 20 minutes? Oh, boy. Okay. All right. So during the night, I'm just going to read the second paragraph. I woke from my dream, and I said to Sarai, my wife, I have dreamt a dream. I'm fearful because of this dream. She said to me, tell me your dream, that I may know. This is Fiddler, that I may know it. So I began to tell her this dream, and then we have some, like, lacuna. We don't know exactly what he says, that they will seek to kill me but will spare you. Say to them of me, he is my brother, and because of you I shall live, and because of you my life shall be safe. And here what we have is really interesting. Sarai, what does she do?
Weeps.
She weeps, but they have a very loving relationship in this text, because she, it's not his fault. He got this dream, right? What was he supposed to do? It was a dream. He had to follow the divinely inspired dream, right? But she cries, and then he cries. So we have her crying, and then we have the scene where she's basically taken by the Egyptians, and they cannot believe how attractive this lady is, right? And I'm not going to go through this, but it's almost Hellenist in, like, the drawn out imagery of the beauty of this woman. How beautiful is her face, how fine are the hairs of her head, how lovely are her eyes, how desirable her nose. I mean, just really goes, how pleasing are her arms, how perfect are her hands, how desirable, wow, all the appearance. I mean, on and on. Her fingers are so slender. Boy, have you ever thought about that with someone? Like, whoa, slender fingers, wow. I mean, it just goes on and on. And then she's taken, right? Sarai said to the king, he's my brother, that I might benefit from her, and I, Avram, was spared because of her. And then look at the underlined. I, Avram, wept aloud that night. I and my nephew, remember, they're best friends. I mean, similar a little bit to Jubilees. Because Sarai had been taken from me by force. Right? So Avram doesn't like this. He's very unhappy. But what could he do? He had a divinely inspired dream. So again, this text exonerates Avram in a way that's really, I think, very intentional and very elegant. But in the opposite way of Jubilees. Jubilees just takes out a few verses. Jubilees omits, skips over. Here we have this incredibly intriguing insertion. Right? And again, I don't think that this is disrespectful. I think that this is homage. I don't think that the writer thought, I'm going to write scripture. But I'm going to imagine how it could have happened that this infallible hero, this incredible patriarch, would have done this thing to his wife. So with our limited time, let's go to my good friend Josephus. Josephus was a late 1st century CE historian. Lots of people think of him as a late 1st century CE traitor. Yeah. I don't like to think of him that way. So he's brought up in a priestly aristocratic family in the environs of Jerusalem. And he is a young man when the war, when the rebellion against the Romans breaks out in 66 CE. Now, the relationship with Rome since 6 CE was never good. In 6 CE, Judea is incorporated into the Roman Empire fully. And it's never good after that. And so tensions just come to, like, an explosive situation in 66 CE. The rebellion just becomes full out. And Josephus, because he's from this very well-known family, is assigned a garrison, a military garrison, to be a general over in the north, in the Galilee. And he goes up to the Galilee to be a general of this garrison, and he's an intellectual. And his tenure as a military general is a disaster. Basically, all of his men die at a place called Yodfat, Jotapata in the Greek. And he survives. There's something called the Josephus riddle or something in math, the Josephus puzzle. You have to look it up on Wikipedia. Josephus something. Basically, he hid in a cave with a few people, a few other Jews. Everybody else who didn't hide in the cave at Yodfat was killed. And the Jews in this cave made a deal. You can't commit suicide according to Jewish law, so we'll all kill each other. And then basically got to Josephus, and he was like, maybe I'm just going to let myself survive the situation. Everybody else in the cave like went around the circle. Everyone killed one another. And then he was like, I think I'm going to surrender to the Romans. And this is by his own account. He writes this in his autobiography, Vita. So again, we don't exactly know what happened because he's very subjective. But he says that he hid out in this cave. Nobody in this cave survived. They all killed each other rather than surrender to the Romans. And then he goes out of the cave and he is taken as a captive by Vespasian to Rome. Before the war is over, they release him to be a translator to Vespasian's son, Titus. So in 69 CE, Josephus goes with Titus back to Jerusalem and acts as his translator. Now, can you imagine being a different general in the army and being like, hey, Josephus, wait a second. You're like in a Roman outfit. Oh my gosh, you're a translator for Titus. That is horrible. We hate you a lot, right? I mean, Josephus was regarded very negatively by people who lost everything in the war, right? Their families, their houses, their city, their lives, right? And Josephus goes to the other side. So we can understand why people, you know, felt strongly about him. And he talks about Jews trying to kill him or arrest him, put him on trial for treason. But in his writings, Josephus works very, very, very hard to argue for the integrity of Judaism. He doesn't give it up. He is not an assimilated Jew. Never, ever. He writes the most systematic defense of the Jewish religion ever written, called Against Appian. It is the first defense of the Jewish religion ever to be, I mean, he invents this genre. He collects every terrible thing that Greeks and Romans said about Jews, and he fights back against it. It's an amazing text. He writes an account of the war of the Jews, where he tries to walk this tightrope of blaming both sides for the war. Which is really surprising because his patron was the Flavian family. So really what he should have done is bash the Jews and praise the Romans, but he doesn't. Not completely. And he writes Antiquities of the Jews, where he rewrites all of Jewish history starting from the beginning of Bereishit. And here we see his love for Judaism really at work, where he's always trying to present Judaism as having integrity. Just like I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, Jews under the Greeks and Romans really wanted their patriarchs and matriarchs to compete with the heroes of the Greek and Roman world. And those were gods, right? And so rather than what the rabbis make their heroes very human and relatable and fallible, right? Very famous Midrash, but Moshe going into the Beit Midrash and not understanding what's happening, right? And then he hears Akiva quote him, right? Akiva says Allah, and they say, how do you know that? And Akiva says, oh, it's from Moshe. And then Moshe like feels a little bit better, but he doesn't understand what's happening. Right, so the rabbis don't shy away from presenting our biblical heroes as people, right? Inspirational, brilliant, very, you know, close with God, but still human. Whereas in the Second Temple period, what Josephus and others do is they lift up the biblical heroes, that they're almost on the level of demigods in a very Homeric way. Okay, so now with that whole preamble, let's see what Josephus says about this story in Bereishit Yod Bet. Okay, does somebody want to read? And we'll start with, let's just start from the beginning. Now after this. Please, because you're in the front. Thank you.
Now after this, when a famine had invaded the land of Canaan, and Abram had discovered that the Egyptians were in a flourishing condition, he was disposed to go down to them, both to partake of the plenty they enjoyed and to become an auditor of their priests, and to know what they said concerning the gods. Designing either to follow them, if they had better notions than he, or to convert them to a better way if his own notions proved the truest.
And this is also pretty midrashic. I mean, when we think about these midrashim, about Avram looking at every religion, right, and thinking, this one no, right? So he's like the ultimate intellectual. He's at this stage, he's still objective. He's still seeking. He's trying to find the truth with a capital T. Hi, there are surcheats, I think, right next to you. And another thing that we'll see here, and we'll also see with Philo, the last source, is that Avram in these sources is not just the greatest intellectual you could imagine, open to all topics, but also the perfect philosopher. Yeah, he's a philosopher. So you'll see that he wants to exchange information with, you can't say Jews, right? Because they're not Jews, they're not even Israelites. With exchange, he wants to exchange information with those who are not in the Abrahamic family. Right? Often we say Jews. I mean, I try to avoid that when we're talking about Avraham. Okay, so now where were we? Seeing he was to take Sarai with him?
Okay. Now seeing he was to take Sarai with him and was afraid of the madness of the Egyptians with regard to women.
That's not so nice.
Lest the king should kill him on occasion of his wife's great beauty, he contrived this device. He pretended to be her brother, and directing her in a dissembling way to pretend the same. For he said it would be for their benefit.
Okay, so as opposed to just completely ignoring the fact that this does come from Avram, Josephus acknowledges that it comes from Avram. This is Avram's idea. But what's his excuse for Avram? We're on page 3 in Josephus, verse 3. She's amenable to it. We have no evidence that this is a problem for her. And it's an absolute necessity. How does he describe the Egyptians?
Mad.
This was extremely common in the late Second Temple period for Jews to, and not only Jews, for Romans and Egyptians, to be very, I don't know if racist is the right word, but there was a lot of anti-Egyptian literature in the late Second Temple period. The Egyptians lived in Egypt, of course, but when Alexander the Great dies, and his kingdom is divided into 3 big parts, one of those big parts is northern Africa. And so Egypt becomes a Hellenized region, right? So when the Greeks come in and sort of make this Ptolemaic Greek empire, the Egyptians are pushed down. The native Egyptians are pushed down. Think of them as Native Americans, right? So they're pushed down a social rung. They were running the show. They had this incredible culture. They had the pyramids, right? They had hieroglyphics. They had, I don't know what they had. They had, you know, incredible cultural
stuff.
Thank you. That was what I was looking for. I was looking for stuff, right? And then the Greeks come in 334 to 333, and we have this Ptolemaic Greek empire, right? We have the Seleucids in Asia, and we have the Antiochians in the northern of the land of Israel, and Turkey, and parts of Europe. But the Egyptians are pushed down. Now, when the Greek empire comes to an end in the middle of the first century BC, who takes over?
Rome.
And now suddenly, now Egypt has these incredible Greek cities, like Alexandria, right? I mean, in beautiful Greek, it's not even Egyptian anymore, but it's a Greek place, right? And now the Romans come in 63 BCE, and they come in, right? They defeat the Greeks, and now the Greeks are pushed down, right? And by the way, we have probably about 1 million Jews. I know we don't like to think of Egypt as being a place where Jews thrive, but they did, right? They thrived in Egypt in the Second Temple period. And so we have Jews, we have Egyptians at the bottom, we have Greeks, and we have Romans. And so what would you do as a Jew to try to lift yourself up a little bit? You'd push those Egyptians down. Do you understand? The Egyptians were not respected by the Greeks and the Romans. But guess what? The Jews were not either. And so we see a lot of anti-Egyptian Jewish literature, but we also see Greeks and Romans being very insulting to the Egyptians. They're ugly, they're dark-skinned, they're dumb, they're archaic, they're backwards, they're not sophisticated, they're not literate enough. All the things, they're not reading Greek, right? All these things were lobbed against the Egyptians. So when we see he was afraid of the madness of the Egyptians, you can imagine a first century CE Jew being like, oh yeah, well, you know, those Egyptians, yeah. No, that makes sense, right? He doesn't have to say too much because Jews had this bias against Egyptians, and if we have time, we'll see it in Philo as well. Just look at the bottom of page 3. I was talking about Avram being the ultimate intellectual and philosopher, and he shares knowledge that with the Egyptians that the Egyptians themselves are known for, right? This is a way of putting Avram sort of on top of the Egyptians, right? What does he do? He communicated to them arithmetic and delivered to them the science of astronomy. What? For before Avram comes into Egypt, they were unacquainted with those parts of learning. I mean, he just like gives Avram all the credit for like the entire field of astronomy. Like, whoop, just goes all the way from Avram to all the Egyptians. For that science came from the Chaldeans into Egypt and from thence to the Greeks also. So basically, Avram is responsible for like everything, all of intellectual history. And Josephus is not the only one to do this. Philo does this as well. Let's turn to Philo. Philo is a fascinating figure. I want to spend the next 5 minutes talking about his biography, but I won't. But I will say one thing. He's an Alexandrian Jew. He lives from around 20 BCE to 50 CE. Around 20 BCE to 50 CE. He witnesses terrible anti-Jewish violence in Alexandria. But a lot of us, when we do talk about Philo, we think of him as an assimilated Greek philosopher. Not true. I'm yelling at you, but I'm thinking of... No, I'm not thinking of you. I mean, Philo is a good Jew. He observes ancestral law. He keeps Shabbat and the holidays. He believes that Jews have to practice circumcision and dietary law. He also writes in beautiful Greek. He also corresponds with Greek philosophers and spends time talking with his Greek interlocutor. I should never say that word out loud. People that he talks with. Interlocutors. And so Philo is, like Josephus, but in a different way, walking a tightrope between wanting to be part of the Greek intellectual philosophical world, but not willing to abandon ancestral law. And he says in many of his treatises that Jews who fully assimilate, Jews who do not keep ancestral law, they are to be criticized. They are to be shunned. So sometimes we think of Philo as being this totally Greek assimilated guy. No. He was part of a big community in Alexandria of Jews who went to synagogue every Shabbat and read their scriptures. Every Shabbat. We know this because he talks about the many synagogues of Alexandria. And he talks about how they were defiled in 30 CE by anti-Jewish violence. Okay. So Philo is an observant Jew. I have 5 minutes. Oh, boy. Okay. And we're going to see that what he does, I guess I'll read this text, is similar to Josephus in his attitude towards the Egyptians. Abraham had a wife of a most excellent disposition. By the way, this is hard English because the Greek is extremely hard. The sentences don't end. The verb is at the end. It's very challenging. So we're going to work on this together. Who was also the most beautiful of all the women of her time. The Egyptian magistrate, seeing her and admiring her exquisite form. Remember the Genesis Apocryphon, the fingers, the wrists, the right? For nothing ever escapes the notice of men of authority. I don't know why he said that. Wow. Gave information to the kind. And the king, no, that's a typo, to the king. That's my typo. And the king, sending for the woman and beholding her extreme beauty, gave but little heed to the dictates of modesty. He doesn't like Pharaoh, right? Or to the laws which had been established with respect to the honor due to strangers, right? There was this cultural value of being nice to strangers. Pharaoh didn't care. But yielding to his incontinent desires, conceived the intention, name, indeed, whew, get to the end, Philo, to marry her, bad translation, it's to take her in lawful wedlock. But, so he doesn't want to marry her in lawful wedlock, but in fact he wants to seduce and defile her. Okay, I mean, on and on and on. But look at the next sentence. The merciful and gracious God who takes compassion on the stranger and who fights on behalf of those who are unjustly oppressed. He gets very theological, right? I mean, none of this, again, is in Brachia Yerbet. Inflicted in a moment painful sufferings and terrible chastisements of the king. Now, think about what he's doing here because it's very rabbinic. Listen carefully. It's hard, but according to Philo, what does God do to Paro? Filling his body and soul with all kinds of miseries difficult to be escaped or remedied so that all his inclinations tending to pleasure were cut short. What happens to Paro?
He gets sick.
He gets sick, so he can't do to Sarai what he wanted to do to Sarai. This is Mita Kenegan Mita, right? It's very clever. We don't see in the text that the plague actually disables him from sleeping with Sarai, right? That's a chiddush that we see in Philo, right? Why a plague? Why not something else, right? Why not a fire? And then Sarai has to, like, go into the, I don't know, local fire station. No, it has to punish the part of his body that he wanted to sin with. Mita Kenegan Mita. On the contrary, he was occupied with nothing but care, seeking an alleviation from his endless and intolerable torments by which he was harassed and tortured day and night. In this manner, the chastity of the woman was preserved. And there are midrashim that talk about the fact that Sarai actually didn't sleep with Paro, right? It's not totally clear in the text, but there are midrashic authors who want to assure us that she was not defiled by Paro. And we see that in this pre-rabbinic text in Philo, right? Lots of interpretations in Philo do make appearances in Midrashic literature as well. Okay, in this manner, the chastity of the woman was preserved, and God condescended to display the excellent and piety. I think it should be excellence and piety of her character. Giving him the noblest reward, namely his marriage, free from all injury. Wow. That's the noblest reward, is that your wife should be a virgin. Okay, that's okay. Or your wife shouldn't be sleeping with anybody else. No, okay. A marriage which, however, was not intended to produce any limited number of sons and daughters, the most God-loving of all nations, and one which appears to me to have received the offices of priesthood and prophecy on behalf of the whole human race. Again, we don't need to understand every single phrase here. But the fact that Josephus and Philo both present Avram not as important just because he's going to start this nation, but as important because of what he contributes to all of humankind, is very significant, right? Remember what Josephus says, that he's teaching the Egyptians basically everything, right? Arithmetic and science and astronomy. And likewise, Philo says that the offices of human priesthood and prophecy all belong to the family of Avram. Reflects a polemical effort on behalf of these first century writers to present the Jews not just as a people of integrity, but as people who contribute to all of the world society, because at this time, Greeks and Romans were saying that Jews aren't contributing. They're bad patriots, right? They're misanthropic. That's a Greek word, which basically means anti-human. They're not good patriots. They're not going to festivals dedicated to the Greek gods, right? Because in the ancient world, religion and politics were not two separate things. They were one thing. So if you didn't go to the festival of Dionysus, you were a bad Greek, right? And the Jews, some of them weren't going. And so people were saying, these Jews, they're not good Greeks, they're not good Romans. And the Jewish intellectuals, Philo, Josephus, and others are saying, no, look at the tradition that we laud, that we come from. Look at our forefathers who contributed more than you ever will. I think I'm out of time. Broadly speaking, the point that I'd like to make is that even before the Bible comes to a state of really total, full canonization in the early rabbinic period, Jews are intrigued by their scriptural text. They imbue themselves with the authority to write interpretations on these texts. Those interpretations are acts of homage, not disrespect. These interpretations, with the exception of Genesis Apocryphon, were widely distributed and popular. And so these interpretations reflect, I think, ideas that were circulating among Jews and not ideas that were Hellenist and marginal to our normative rabbinic tradition. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Oh, and I'm sorry I didn't leave time for questions, so I'll be here for a few minutes if you do have questions.
It's like filling in all the stuff. I'm thinking like with Rashi, when you bring Rashi.
He saw the problem, he said, okay, you're going to ask this question, here's how I'm going to preemptively answer. Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, it's very nutritious.
Second temple preparation is my field.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. This is going to sound like a total stupid question. No, bears. Oh, wait, let me make sure I turn this off. Sorry.